this session on Radical Luther, Just War. God willing, and my voice holding up, I'll introduce you today to some of Luther's views on war, and specifically just war. I'd like to point out at the outset that we're engaged in what I call an anachronistic exercise. That is, we're looking at something from the 16th century and then ripping it out bodily and asking whether it has any relevance to the 20th. And in the area of politics, this is a particularly problematic exercise, because Luther lived in a world very different from ours, a world in which there were princes and city councils, where society was organized very hierarchically, you know, with the notion of people being born into certain stations in life and expected to stay there. This was a view that was founded in religion, but also in law. It was also an age in which there was considerable fear of anarchy, of a whole society coming apart at the seams. It was an age in which probably 95% of the people were illiterate. Most were peasants. It was an age in which the other great superpower, the Turks, were literally knocking on the door in Eastern Europe. The city of Vienna was besieged, for example, in 1529 and almost fell. It was an age of frequent war. It was also an age of uprisings and revolts, the most famous of which being the 1525 Peasants' Uprising, in which bands of peasants throughout southern and central Germany rose up and attempted to defeat their lords on a variety of issues that they were pushing. It was also a period of religious wars. Luther died in 1546 in February, and in the summer of that year, the Catholic princes and of the Holy Roman Empire attacked the Protestant princes of the Holy Roman Empire and defeated them. And there was a time where it looked like Protestantism and Lutheranism would be rolled back completely. It's an age very different from our own today. So we have to be careful about drawing conclusions from his view of politics and applying it to our own. Having said that, I think it probably is worthwhile going through some of his basic beliefs, and also, before doing that, let me give you some background in the Christian tradition. I have, for lack of a blackboard, I have this piece of paper and put some things on it so that some notion of where I'm going in all this. To begin with, war for Christians is always considered an evil. It may be a necessary evil, but it is always seen as being evil. It's a concession to the fallen condition of humanity. Now, early Christians, to the extent we can determine their attitudes, the earliest Christians seem to have been pacifists. That is, they refused to participate in war in any form. This was not so much because they objected to war as due to the fact they expected the world to come to an end soon. And so wars which were fought for temporal ends seem kind of silly. We do find, however, Christian soldiers early on. And of course, with the conversion of Constantine to Christianity in the early 4th century, and Christianity becoming the favored and ultimately the solely legitimate religion of the empire, Christian attitudes towards war and peace had to change, because it's one thing to be a small minority sect opposed to the world and maintaining one's purity. It's a whole other matter to be involved as the guiding religion of a whole empire, an empire which was beset by enemies on three of the four boundaries. That is, there were German barbarians pushing from the north, there were Persians, and then later various Asiatic groups pushing from the east, and there were Berber tribesmen and Arabs and others pushing from the south. And so the Holy Roman Empire, the Roman Empire at the time, the Christian Roman Empire, it was very easy for Christians to identify the empire with Christianity, because all these people were pagan or heretics, and they were attacking the empire. Basically, there were two positions about war, or at least legitimate war, in the classical age, and was carried into the medieval period. or three, actually. There was pacifism, just war, crusade. As I say, most of the early Christians were pacifists. They believed literally in the commandment, resist not evil, turn the other cheek, bless those who persecute you. And so it was thought that that included war, and you should not participate in war and shedding of blood. Once the Christianity and the empire began to cooperate with each other, the ideal of pacifism was maintained, but it was given to a select group within the Christian community. That is, the Christian community was divided into two halves. Well, they're not even half, but two sections. There was the laity, most people, for whom just the Ten Commandments applied. And there was a small group, the clergy, or what was called the spiritual estate, to whom applied not only the Ten Commandments, but also what came to be called the counsels of Christ, that is, Christ's advice. And one of those would resist not evil or turn the other cheek. And so it was felt that clergymen, and it was mainly clergymen, should not participate in war. They would maintain the high ideal. But lay people were not called to that same high standard. So the pacifism continues, at least in theory, among the clergy. For the laity, there were two options, and both of them are closely associated with Augustine. You've probably heard of Augustine. He lived in the late 4th and early 5th century, died in 430 of the Common Era. He is one of the greatest theologians in Christian history, and it would not be inappropriate to say that all of Western theology could be written as a footnote to Augustine, or as footnotes to Augustine. He just really defines so many of the issues which are important. And that's true also with both just war and crusade. The just war was a notion that had been developed by the classical. You're getting a real academic lecture here.
We're in a circle.
You're in a circle, despite that. The just war was the notion that when you fought a war, it had to be for just cause, and normally with the goal of reestablishing peace. That, in a nutshell, was the early form. It was then elaborated by others. The crusade, though, is also something that is associated to a certain extent with Augustine. And that was the notion that you could use force, including war, in order to bring about religious ends. In Augustine's case, he was the bishop of a small town in northern Africa. And in northern Africa, there was a dispute that went back, about 100 years, about which was the pure church. In earlier persecutions, before the empire had become Christian, two groups had formed. One which had refused to give way in front of the persecution, the other which had cooperated some. And then those who had been pure insisted that only they possessed the true sacraments. These were called the Donatists. And they refused to have anything to do with the rest of the church, not only in North Africa, but throughout the Mediterranean, because they had been tainted. They had been involved in compromise with the imperial persecution. And originally, they were in the majority in Augustine's area, and he, preached sort of pacifism, turn the other cheek and all in dealing with them. But then the emperor got involved and sent his armies and forced the Donatists back into the church. And Augustine was forced to rethink his position. And he came to the conclusion, for a variety of reasons, that in fact the force that was exercised in this case may have been part of God's providence. That is, the way in which God was using the world and even the wickedness of the world to bring about God's own goals or aims. And that is, the force had brought these people back into the church, and many of these Donatists then became sincere Catholic Christians. Augustine told a story, which he used to illustrate this, of a schoolboy friend of his, who both when he and Augustine were Manichees and didn't believe in Christianity, but this friend of his had Christian parents, and the friend became very ill, and while in a coma, his parents had him baptized. And then he had a brief recovery, and Augustine joked with him about, "Now, isn't that funny? Your parents baptized you, and you think that would somehow make you a Christian." And the friend, instead, according to Augustine, had responded very harshly to know that, in fact, he now really did believe. And shortly thereafter, he had a relapse and died. Augustine said that what happened here is that the power of the sacraments was at work. The sacraments had, in fact, converted this person, even though he'd been unconscious. and that the God had intended for this person to be brought to the Christian fold through the sacraments. And similarly, the Donatists had been, those who eventually became sincere Catholic Christians had been intended by God for that eventual goal, and God had carried it out through the use of force. And this was the theory underlying the crusade, that to bring about conversion, it was permissible in some cases to use force. So it's a notion that makes me very uncomfortable. But this is the rationale behind it. If we jump from Augustine, who dies in 430, to Martin Luther, who lived in the first half of the 16th century, we find that pacifism is still, at least in theory, the domain only of the clergy. The just war has been elaborated, and the crusade is actively preached, especially against the Turk, which I told you was pushing against the boundaries of the empire. But the crusade had also, when it's been preached against the Turk, it also ended up in slaughter of Jews. The first crusade in the early 11th century, crusaders went off to liberate the Holy Land, and it was preaching that, you know, that God would favor this use of force to bring about divine ends. The group, the soldiers that heard this, decided, well, they might as well start at home, and so they massacred thousands of Jews in the Rhineland and elsewhere on their way to the east. And the crusade, though, was still alive and well in Luther's day. We're going to talk next time about Luther's notion of the two governments. Suffice it to say that in his political ethic, Luther at this time said that there were two basic forms of government, both established by God. God had established temporal government or secular government, which ruled through the sword. It was there for the curbing of evil. It was a necessary part of the world. Because of the sinful nature of human beings, there had to be government. Most people were not Christians, so most people needed coercion. And God had created government and the power of the sword. The other form of government was the spiritual government, the church. And there, the only coercive force, according to Luther, was the Word of God. Could not use force. The only force was the Word. You preach the Word, and the Word either would convince through the power of the Holy Spirit or would not. And if it did not convince, that was the end of it. There was no way of using coercion, he said, to bring about a true faith. I have a quote I'd like to share with you on that. For God has established two kinds of government among human beings. The one is spiritual. It has no sword, but it has the Word, by means of which people are to become good and righteous, so that with this righteousness they may attain eternal life. God administers this righteousness through the Word, which God has committed to the preachers. The other kind is worldly government, which works through the sword, so that those who do not want to be good and righteous to eternal life may be forced to become good and righteous in the eyes of the world. God administers this righteousness through the sword. And although God will not reward this kind of righteousness with eternal life, nonetheless, God still wishes peace to be maintained among people and rewards them with temporal blessings. Thus, God is the founder, Lord, master, protector, and rewarder of both kinds of righteousness. There is no human ordinance or authority in either, but each is a divine thing entirely.
Where is that?
That's from his Whether Soldiers Too May Be Saved. Well, there are a number of other places we can find similar. So we're now moving within the realm of the secular government, which is also ordained by God, and in which the sword is the form of coercion, and it's there to restrain sin. And it is within that that Luther then talks about three types of wars. And time permitting, we will talk about two of them, but I want to focus initially on one, which is war between equals. That is, two sovereign states. He also discusses war between lords and subjects, where the lords fighting against the subjects, and then the other one, subjects against lord, what we call rebellion or revolution. And that one, time permitting, we'll talk about that one, revolution, because it's one which I think, given today's events, is one that can make us quite uncomfortable. His position can make us quite uncomfortable. Martin Luther, in talking about war between equals, that is, between two sovereign states, enumerated a number of criteria which she said had to be met in order for a Christian properly to participate in the war. Now, the person then participates in the war not as a Christian, but as a subject, as a member of the state, because it's purely a secular matter. As a Christian, the only way, as Christian, a Christian can only fight with the Word of God. But as a member of the body politic participating in a war, there still are these various criteria that should be met. To begin with, Luther insisted a war had to be defensive. At the very outset, I want to say that whoever starts a war is in the wrong. He made no exception to that. Preventive attack, or anticipating the attack of someone else, was wrong, as far as he was concerned. It had to be defensive. Let this be then the first thing to be said in this matter. No war is just, he writes, even if it is a war between equals, unless one has such a good reason for fighting and such a good conscience that he, and we would add, or she can say, my neighbor compels and forces me to fight, though I would rather avoid it. In that case, it can be called not only war, but lawful self-defense. For we must distinguish between wars that someone begins, because that is what he or she wants to do and does before anyone else attacks, and those wars that are provoked when an attack is made by someone else. The first kind can be called wars of desire, the second wars of necessity. The first kind are of the devil. God does not give good fortune to the man, it's a person who wages that kind of war. The second kind are human disasters. See, it's still evil. God help in them. So it had to be defensive. Secondly, it had to have a just cause. And in the notion of just cause, he included the notion that it had to be waged by properly appointed authorities. An individual, a private individual, could not just decide that he or she was going to wage war, according to Luther. Thirdly, it had to have a goal, and that goal always had to be peace and obedience. That is, wars were necessary evils intended to avert a greater evil, and the goal was to bring about peace. And Luther added obedience.
And that is
obedience.
What does that mean?
Obedience would be obedience to a proper authority. So putting down a rebellion would be.
And that's the return to orderliness.
That's right. Return to a civilized society, which would be ordered society.
Can you give an example of a cause, just cause?
A just cause? Well, the most common just cause was someone attacked you. You didn't do anything to provoke it. Luther, in practice, there were a variety the main one was that you were attacked and you didn't provoke the attack. The fourth point was that all war should be fought in fear of God. Now, this would be true even of non-Christian authorities fighting a war. I mean, Luther points out that a Christian prince is a rare bird in heaven. The way we would put it is most governments are not Christian. In any case, they don't have to be Christian. They just have to follow the dictates of prudence, reason, and justice. But if the ruler is Christian, the ruler should undertake his or her war, or the government should, without confidence that necessarily they will succeed. Luther and Augustine before him were realists enough to know that a just cause was no guarantee of success in war. They both could point to the many examples in the Hebrew scriptures of the Israelites possessing fully just cause and yet nevertheless being defeated. They both made a great deal of the fact that God often used the enemies of the people of God as a way of punishing sin. There was no guarantee if your cause was righteous or just that you would succeed. No simple equation, which often was found in crusading ideology, that if God was on your side, you'd have to win. On the contrary, because all human beings, including Christians, are sinful, God could always allow people to lose as punishment for their sin. The final point that he made was that the means by which a war was waged had to be commensurate or proportionate to the ends that were intended. He puts this in a particularly in a typically colorful way. A prince must punish the wicked in such a way that does not step on the dish while picking up the spoon. And for the sake of one man's head, plunge country and people into want and fill the land with widows and orphans. Let this be the rule. Where wrong cannot be punished without greater wrong, there let the prince waive his rights, however just they may be. That is, no matter how just the war would be and how much it fits these other criteria, the amount of evil that's to come out of fighting the war is greater than any good that the war is intended to create or any evil it was intended to advert, then the war would no longer be just. I think that's particularly interesting because in a world of nuclear weapons, one could argue, and it frequently now is argued, that given the means of nuclear exchange, no war can meet a classical just war definition, because the means will also always bring about more evil than any. Well, the notion of commensurate means goes back to the classical. Cicero talks about it, and Thomas Aquinas elaborates it in some detail. Luther is, in much of this, unoriginal. The few areas where he is original, which I'll point out again in a moment, is the notion that has to fully defend the way he handles the two governments and his attitude towards the crusade, which I'll come back to in a minute. As far as unjust wars are concerned, I was a draft and military counselor during the Vietnam War, helping young men work out their position if they were applying for conscientious objection or had other concerns that they thought should disqualify them from military service. And Lutherans, it was always very difficult with Lutherans because at least well into the war, the argument was made that, you know, Lutherans should obey government and didn't hold a pacifist position. And it's true, they don't hold an absolute pacifist position. They hope they come from a just war opposition. But there's nevertheless is strong precedent with not only with Luther, but within Lutheranism for refusal to participate in what is an individual considers to be an unjust war. A second question, Luther writes, suppose my lord, now he's speaking of a prince, were wrong in going to war. I reply, if you know for sure that he is wrong, then you should fear God rather than men. Acts 4. Actually, it's Acts 5, 29. Luther always quoted from memory, and occasionally he'd get it wrong. Also, he never quotes verse numbers, because verse numbers were not given until the 17th century. So, it's always chapter. And you should neither fight nor serve, for you cannot have a good conscience before God. Oh no, you say, my lord would force me to do it. He would take away my fief. And we're talking here about nobles who have entered into a contract where they're given land and the product of this land in exchange for military service. And there's a contract. And if you don't provide the military service, then you don't get the land. Of course, your prince may have to use military service to get it away from you. But at least in theory, there's this exchange. My lord would force me to do it. He would take away my fief and would not give me my money, pay, wages. Besides, I would be despised and put to shame as a coward. Even worse, as a man who did not keep his word. That is, he's entered into an oath of fealty to the Lord, saying that he would come when called to serve the Lord. Who did not keep his word and deserted his Lord in need. I answer, says Luther, you must take that risk, and with God's help, let whatever happen, happen. Whatever happens, happen. In every other occupation, we are also exposed to the danger that the rulers will compel us to act wrongly, he adds. But since God will have us leave even father and mother for God's sake, we must certainly leave lords for God's sake. So he argued strongly that if you knew the war was unjust or suspected it was unjust, you had the right, the responsibility to refuse and then take whatever punishment came. That is, he advocated what we call today passive resistance. He did add, if you were uncertain of whether the cause was just or not, then you should go ahead and participate, because it was the government's responsibility to make that up. And if you were uncertain, then you could, in good conscience, participate. But if you were convinced that it was unjust, you had a Christian responsibility. Even though it was a secular matter, you as a Christian had the responsibility to refuse to participate. Finally, and then I'd like to open things up to discussion, and then time permitting, we can come back to the others. And this is something where Luther is unusual. He insisted that war was purely a secular matter, and that any attempt to fight war for religious reasons was the devil's handiwork. Any attempt to say that God favored this side or that side, or that we were fighting for Christ, was to confuse the two kingdoms, what he called it, or the two governments. Put it another way, or to repeat what I said earlier, the only coercion within the realm of the Christian was the word of God. And so to claim that as Christians you should be bearing the sword and striking down people as Christians, you were violating the separation which he saw between the two realms.
Does that mean he opposed the Crusades then?
He certainly did, and got into a lot of trouble for it.
How does that fit in with his song, Onward Christian Soldiers?
Well, that's Onward Christian Soldiers is not his song. No. No. I mean, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. But A Mighty Fortress Is Our God is talking about spiritual warfare, not. He said at one point, they, that is the Catholics, undertook to fight against the Turk in the name of Christ and taught and incited people to do this as though our people were an army of Christians against the Turks who were enemies of Christ. This is absolutely contrary to Christ's doctrine and name. It is against God's doctrine, or Christ's doctrine, because he says that Christians shall not resist evil, fight or quarrel, nor take revenge or insist on rights. It is against his name because there are scarcely 5 Christians in such an army. It's probably true. And perhaps there are worse people in the eyes of God in that army than are in the Turks. And yet they all want to bear the name of Christ. This is the greatest of all sins, and is one that no Turk commits, for Christ's name is used for sin and shame and thus dishonored. That didn't mean he was against fighting against the Turks, but he should fight against the Turks only as a defensive war. If the Turk attacked, then under duly constituted authority, the emperor, one could resist. But to make it a Christian obligation or to fight as Christians was, he felt, a confusion and was the devil's handiwork. There was a good reason for him arguing this way, because he wanted to argue that coercion and force should not be used in religious matters in general. And if he conceded this point, he would have to concede, for example, that force could be used to reimpose Catholicism on Protestant lands. He got into a lot of trouble for this and was accused of being a supporter of the Turks and a traitor, and was forced to reply to this. Having presented this, I'd like to open the discussion to two issues, and then if we run out of things to say, we can come back to the issue of revolution, which is much more problematic. First off, his attitude towards crusade and the Turks reminds me a lot of our discussion of godless communism and the crusade against the evil empire, which is a major part of certain conservative denominations. It's often discussed by Jerry Falwell and company. And I wonder whether we as Lutherans might not have something to say about that. The other issue, the broader issue, is what do you think of this notion of criteria, and how would you apply them in the contemporary situation, or do you think they're totally irrelevant today in a world of balanced, mutually assured destruction? I think that's a very important question. And can I be mean and nasty and suggest that we want to hold that for next week tomorrow when we talk about the two governments? It's a real problem. But what's involved there is certainly not war, and it's not between governments. But it seems to me that issue is implicit in some of this discussion.
Yeah, I don't want to get this off track.
Yeah.
Okay.
Other questions, by the way, are there questions I should ask?
I have a historical question. under what circumstances or what was the context in which we could then address these issues, even though they're not his own, per se?
Well, he
how is it that he came to address the issues in himself?
Well, he came to address it because the Turks were attacking, and armies composed of both Protestants and Catholics were going out to repel the Turks. So, and that happened at least three times during his period of he's an active reformer. There was the peasants' uprising in 1524-25, which he dealt with in some length, and for which he's often criticized into the 20th century. And then there was the threat and the actual exercise of Catholic force against Protestants on several occasions. I say, right, as soon as going to attack around 1530, again 1536-37, again 1542, and they actually did attack a few months after his death in 1546. And so the issue of that sort of war. Beyond that, and this was a very warlike time, there were wars between the Germans and the French, what are called the Habsburg-Valois Wars, which had three rounds during his lifetime. Four rounds during his lifetime. And there were also all sorts of minor skirmishes going on. There were somewhere between 200 and 300 independent principalities or territories within the Holy Roman Empire. And when they weren't fighting someone like the Turks, they often were fighting each other.
My other question is, what is the origin of crusade?
Well, the crusade, as I say, the origin of the crusading idea and the rationale goes back to Augustine and others.
Well, what about Judaism?
What?
What about Judaism?
Well, you have...
Oh, was it Hesed or whatever it is? The Holy, you know, the Islam continues that.
Yeah, well, the Jihad, the Holy War. Yeah. Well, the Crusade as defined by Christians is somewhat different than the Holy War they still have to deal with some of these other issues about turning the other cheek and resisting evil. And so, yes, certainly they could go back and often did use the Israelites and their, you know, butchering people right and left as justification for what they were doing. But the Crusade, at least as a Christian idea in the West, goes back to Ambrose and Augustine. I didn't talk about Ambrose, but he also was involved in several actions in which...
I just raised the issue because it seems to me when you say you read, what about today? That one of the things that happened is the collapse of the two kingdoms in our side of the world. Well, both sides of the world. One went one direction, one has gone some a little bit the other direction. Here, it seems to me we are much closer to a theocracy than might have been the case in Luther's thinking.
How do you mean?
Well, that this country, but in terms of Puritans, is thought of as kind of the Holy Land, the New Israel. And that the whole concept of jihad is based on land, because people like Walter Brueggemann and so forth. And it's a land-based, ethno-geography kind of thing. And it seems to me that when we talk about, for example, Nicaragua, that the whole issue of the communists being on our borders, and that is just reason then to fight in a sense a crusade. Because this is a holy land. It is the last bastion of hope for the world. Now, those are all political words, potentially, but what I'm talking about is the consciousness or the collective consciousness of the West, which I think is kind of religious. But now it begins to point back, I think, to a pre-Christian time when there is a fusion of ethnogeography and religious life, which was different from the time.
Well, yeah. Very briefly, and you and I could talk about this in more detail, just the two of us. remember, America's heritage is not Lutheran; it comes through Calvinism, and it develops differently. I would think the position, at least one of my hopes in proposing this session, was that in fact, given this structure, which is classically Lutheran, it may be used as a means of critiquing just the sort of ideology you were enunciating.
Yes, but that's ultimately where I was going to head, which is really what you're going to talk about tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'd like to go to point E on there, bear with me in a roundabout way of getting at it. It seems to me one of the most difficult things for a parish pastor, and I'm not at this time, but I have been, when I was in the parish, is to deal with people who are both sides of an issue, both claim to be Christian, in their interpretation of what ends are justifiable and what happens. And just using the example of nuclear war, for example, if on the one side you have people who say the means are not commensurate with the end because virtual wiping out of the entire population could occur, therefore it is unjust to be involved in this war or to take up nuclear arms. That's one side of the issue for people in a congregation. However, I can see people on the other side, and I'm not advocating nuclear war, but I could see people say, even if nuclear war would virtually wipe out the population, but not totally, you might end up with some people left similar to Noah and the flood or something, and somehow some good could come out of you. I mean, I pose that because there are people who, on both sides, can justify their issues. And I think what happens is that we often say one is Christian and the other isn't. Whereas in the Christian church, somehow we have to still respect that whatever reasons we have for it, you know, we may still come from a point of faith in terms of how we arrive at the conclusions we do.
Oh, I certainly agree. And in the secular realm, determining whether the means are commensurate with the end is an exercise in what is called theologically prudence, which is simply the exercise of reason. You're not granted special insight through your faith on that, at least in the classical Lutheran presentation. Your discussion, though, about few might survive like Noah in the flood, though, reminds me of a Herblock cartoon after Strom Thurmond had talked about it. He wanted, after, if there was a complete destruction, he wanted at least a couple good Americans to survive. Show the crumbling ruins and these two blacks are coming out. Which is not probably what Strom Thurmond had in mind. Yes.
Given that the first prerequisite for war is that it's defensive, where does the situation where our government would go to the aid of a smaller country who has been attacked, or put it on our level, if I saw someone being attacked, but it would mean I go to war to defend them, am I fighting a just war, or do I have a higher level, which is I am my brother's keeper?
Well, a couple of things. One, you as a private individual could not fight a just war. It has to be done with proper authority. Okay. But when he's dealing with the, as we'll talk about tomorrow, the two governments, or Zwei Regimenter, he says that if you, he argues that as a Christian you should resist not evil if it's done to you, but as a Christian out of love for your neighbor you should resist evil if it's being done to your neighbor.
Does that make it just war then?
No, it wouldn't make it a just. I'm talking about if you as an individual saw somebody else being attacked.
What about if our country went to support a smaller country that was attacked? And they were fighting a just war. Would we be fighting a just war if we joined them, although we personally weren't attacked?
I don't know. What do you think? What do you think?
Well, I want you to answer another question before we figure out what we think, and that's what's proper authority?
Yeah. No, I mean, let me come up. I don't know the answer to that question. It's an exercise in prudence. You would have to still go through all of these other things. Whether we, our country, had a just cause, were our proper authorities, and in this case, it would have to be a declaration of war by Congress, since that's our legal structure for how war is supposed to be fought. Our goal would have to be peace and obedience, not necessarily the suppression of communism, godless atheist communism. It had to be done in fear of God and with an understanding we might lose. And then the ends that we employed to bring about the end of this war, you know, if we napalm the hell out of them, the question might be that even though all these first have been met, this one may not be. And that's the easy answer. The hard answer is would require knowing exactly what the circumstances were. Prudence is a combination of reason and general principles with specific circumstances. You'd have to know what those circumstances were, and then you would work out your decision with fear and trembling. They understand you might be wrong. Yeah.
Is there any concept of non-inclusion, non-combatants? I know Augustine talks about not making sure that non-combatants are not included in the war.
Right.
I wonder if Luther talks about
that. Yeah, Luther does too, but as a practical matter, he realized that that was great in theory, but in practice all sorts of people got killed. Yeah. No. And then once again, the question had to be whether more non-combatants, as it were, would have been harmed if they hadn't gone to war.
But I still want to get back to proper authorities, because I think that's a real key issue in terms of the 20th century scene and the question of American involvement in wars elsewhere in the world. How do we judge, what are the criteria by which we judge whether some particular government or some particular opposing group in a country is in fact a proper authority? Or does Luther just say, you know, whoever is in power is proper at the moment?
No, once again, though, that's a prudential decision. You would have to decide with use of your reason on the base of the information you could gather. I mean, this is not a formula that can be applied without thinking. Okay. You would have to yourself decide whether you thought that was proper authority. That's one of the reasons why, for example, there are some people calling for the Contras to declare themselves a government in exile. It would make them a proper authority.
I was going to make a comment on those 5 points. If one follows that through, it seems that World War II would be justifiable, but that when they got to the point and said unconditional surrender, they had crossed over a line that Luther wouldn't allow, simply because it was putting something on the Allies' side that would not be totally legitimate. You know, that we're totally right in what we're doing. And by doing that, the war was prolonged. Now, of course, hindsight's very easy, but indeed it was prolonged because of that declaration of unconditional surrender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question is, did it violate C? Mm-hmm. And then to carry it out, did it violate E?
On point E, going back to that issue, that was sort of interesting. Luther did never condemn the notion of being armed.
No.
And appropriately armed.
Right, no, the sword was properly in the hands of temporal authorities.
Of course, you could never envision what we now have, which is the sword to beat all swords. Mm-hmm. And the issue then that we're not at nuclear war. No nuclear war has been declared. And there are those who are Christians who believe the reason there has been none is because of nuclear weapons. What is it called? Mutual destructive capabilities.
Yeah, mutually assured.
Maybe mutual assured spirit. That's that very notion, which is very, probably pretty close to, I think, Luther's understanding of the temporal kingdom and how you keep things in check by fear. And so that it is this fear of mutually assured destruction. This is the rationale now. There are, I think, pretty thoughtful Christians who do hold this. That we've had the longest period. We now have had just this year, just this past week, I think, the longest period of no war in the history of the country, in terms of our country's involvement, at least.
Does that count Vietnam?
Huh?
Does that count Vietnam or Korea?
Well,
those were police acts.
Those were police actions. Those were not declared wars as such. But I think the Western world has had the longest period of peace within its own borders of any as region since I don't know what. So the point I'm making is that the issue now is not do we fight a nuclear war? Nobody wants that. The issue is do we disarm? That's the issue about the nuclear holocaust today. That's what's at stake, is should we disarm? Which is something I don't know if Luther ever even addressed.
Well,
you should disarm.
Well, now wait a minute. I would argue that the issue is a little different than that. The issue is whether we can be properly committed to a strategy of man, mutually assured destruction. Are there not other strategies which involve a better ratio of means to ends? And that disarmament, I mean, I'm a pacifist. I'd be glad to disarm right down to the skin. But most people, when they talk about ending the threat of nuclear war, certainly not talking about getting rid of conventional forces.
Well, that's true.
Even with nuclear forces, you could argue that there are strategies which reduce, which might still have the be able to balance without the consequences of the mutually assured destruction strategy. I'm not wanting to advocate one or the other.
No, I understand. But I just think they're saying is that, I mean, that's kind of a new question for us in a way. Is the issue of, before the actual event, we have to decide, are the means commensurate?
Yeah, well, look, Luther lived in an age where when you fought war, most of the time, that meant literally picking up this big heavy piece of iron and battering some poor person to death. There were many people at the time who felt cannons, which were about 100 years old at the time, Luther, a little less, had violated the means end and you no longer could have just war. And then rifles are the primitive ancestor of the rifle. There were knights who they captured a peasant with a rifle in the war and they had executed him. Because this low-born person could, from a distance, shoot down a knight on horse with steel on and kill him. That wasn't fair, as far as they were concerned.
The question still is legitimate, though, because there are people in Pentagon, as well as over in Russia, who argue that a nuclear war is survivable, given the proper approach.
Yeah, but whether or not anyone survives has really almost nothing to do with the issue of whether the cost is worth it.
That quote that you gave from Luther about the prince saying, you know, if you know that you're going to be creating a lot more destruction than it's worth right. on both sides, then mm-hmm. it's not...
I mean, there's a nuclear war that prevents us from being taken over by Russia that costs 50% of both of our populations instead of 100%. Is that a price worth paying?
Yeah, the point I'm making, though, here is that it's a different situation because that one assumed you're going to war. This one assumes we're not. That's the whole point of mutual assured destruction. The assumption is we will not go to war.
Yeah, except it's predicated on the fact that if we do go to war, yes. we will do certain things. And then it is war and has to meet these tests.
Yeah.
Let's get some other people into the discussion.
I have a historical question. When the Catholic dukes and princes attacked the Lutheran provinces, was it solely for religious reasons, or did they want to scoop up some of their territory in a temporal gain sort of thing?
Oh, I'm sure it was both. But the primary reason was religious.
Okay.
They also intended to... consolidate land and round off the edges of their own. And for example, a Protestant, Moritz of Saxony, actually fought with the Catholics. And in exchange for his cooperating, he got the electoral title. He moved up within the pecking order in the empire. And later on, he joined with the Protestants and they defeated the Catholics. And then we ended up with the Peace of Augsburg in 1555. But he did it clearly. Religion had nothing to do with it. It was what was best for his house and his dynasty. And this theory is all well and good, but in practice, in Luther's day, just as our own, few people paid any attention to the theory.
What kind?
Except perhaps ex post facto to justify what they had already done.
What kind of questions did Lutherans that you counseled have as the Vietnam War was into the latter parts?
Well, briefly, the draft law at the time stated you had to be opposed to all war in order to be counted as a conscientious objector. Lutherans take the position that they're opposed to only wars that are unjust or that fail to meet these criteria. So that meant that they were being turned down. And what I did with those is lead them to they had to decide themselves, I couldn't impose it upon them, but try to lead them through so that they themselves believed that there were wars that were just, but no war that they were likely to fight in would ever meet these criteria. And that was not that hard to do with the Vietnam War because you have aerial bombardment, you have non-combatant, you have the free fire zones and a whole variety of things, which meant that it failed this test. And that you don't have to become a conscious objector, you don't have to fight every war. You don't have to refight World War II. The courts indicated that you just had to object to any war that you were going to be called to fight in. or that could conceivably call, and so then Lutherans could qualify.
That's sort of how it works.
Thinking for a moment about the idea of whether or not there is, you can really defend the idea of just war. Could you, as a historian, think of a war that you would like to defend on this basis?
No.
And I can't. I've been sitting here trying to think of any war that I would like to defend on this basis, and I can't. And I come to the conclusion that just war is kind of a meaningless concept.
Well, the classic one that's brought up and was brought up during the Vietnam War was World War II. And the problem is that you can certainly go back after the fact and make it fit these criteria, but if you actually ask what the motives were and how it was actually fought, you have trouble. The problem is, though, that a Christian, I mean, you're in a very ambiguous situation in any case. I mean, if you're a pacifist and refuse, then you're responsible for the evil that comes about by the failure to oppose someone like Hitler. But if you then go ahead and participate, you're responsible for the evil that comes about because of the war. And how do you balance that out? I think that's an individual.
I have a real problem with C there, I guess, in that, you know, it just seems real contradictory to me to have that kind of a goal for peace and obedience. You know, I've been trying to raise our children with the idea that there are nonviolent ways to be peacemakers. And that's a real concern of mine in our society today, especially with children, in the kinds of toys and things that they are on the market for them to play with, that that they're learning that there's all these violent ways of, you know, creating their end result. And that just seems to me a real contradictory concept there, you know, that you have a war to create peace.
Well, I mean, if you assume that what's happened is you've been attacked.
Right.
And so obviously there isn't peace.
Right.
And you're fighting the war to restore peace. I think one thing you have to think about from our modern perspective, Luther's dealing with a hierarchical society where he thinks the power goes to the princes and they're exercising it for God. We live in a representative democracy in which the power starts at the people and is given up to the government and can be taken back. It seems to me that if you're interested in rationalizing things, you can rationalize nonviolent resistance in a democracy much better than you can in a princedom.
Yeah.
Because we are the source of authority, so we are the government ultimately. Whereas Luther didn't see it that way because he lived in a world that couldn't conceive of democracy except as anarchy. The word democracy meant anarchy. And given his circumstances, I'd be hard-pressed to argue that he wasn't right. I mean, given the conditions of the time, that if they had tried to put together a democracy, it would have been a mess, because they just simply didn't have the people who could maintain a democracy.
And yet, if we were to transfer this over now into modern day, though, as Lutherans, you know, it just doesn't, to me, it doesn't all figure in.
Right, and as I said at the beginning, this is an anachronistic exercise. We've jumped over four centuries.
Yeah.
And we're Christians. We're Christians first, Lutherans second, and we're responsible as Christians. We have to be obedient to Christ, not to Luther. And if Luther's wrong, but I think at least it's stimulating some discussion. Well, I think that determining whether it's a just war or not is once again a prudential decision. If you look at, for example, frequently it's argued, well, look at what was happening to the Jews, and that we were preventing this evil by fighting the war. But if you study what we actually did, you realize that we were not fighting the war to save the Jews. And we, in fact, deliberately did not take steps that would have helped. We used means, not merely the atomic bomb, but also, say, the firebombing of Dresden, which were well beyond. I did not want to subscribe specifically to the unconditional surrender, although one could also argue there that by insisting on that, at least some people could argue that that was not, that violated. Others could make an argument similar to yours. I mean, as human beings, we don't have absolute answers to any of these prudential ones. But each of us nevertheless has the responsibility to make his or her own decision when called upon.
You wouldn't agree that the use of the atomic bomb in Japan actually saved all.
Well, I think it probably did, given the goal of unconditional surrender. But that if There's strong evidence that had we allowed just the emperor to stay on, which we ultimately did, but if we had originally said the emperor could stay and made a few other really minor concessions, that they would have surrendered. And we would have never had to invade Japan. And so the million, the tens of thousands or millions of lives that we saved by dropping atomic bombs may never have been at risk. That's at least arguable.
What about the comparison of the firebombing of Dresden against the bombing of London as a...
Well, but that's a tit for tat. The fact that they violate their war is unjust doesn't give us the right to be unjust.
It seems to me the benefit of this criterion is not so much to establish an objective conclusion that this war is legitimate or that war isn't. The benefit, it seems to me, is to the individual Christian and his or her conscience in having some criteria to evaluate the situation so that I might conclude, yes, I can participate in this war. Someone else equally faithful to God may conclude I can't. And it seems to me it still gives you some criteria to weigh the points through.
Yeah, the hope is that it acts as a heuristic. It helps you think about the problem and break it down. And there's a lot of other writings, modern writings, on these issues, which takes it well beyond Luther. But at least as Christians, this may help us to think about it some. If no other, you can be influenced by this by rejecting it. But if you reject it, then you at least have to come up with other notions which make more sense to you, so that even in a negative way, this can be of use.
I've heard that Bonhoeffer, in referring to Hitler, use that analogy of car, vehicle out of control, going down, killing all kinds of people. You got to stop the car.
Could you explain the commensurate means that Luther had in mind? Well, was it if someone comes at you with a sword, you should come back with the same type of sword, kind of equal thing? Or,
well,
you know what he meant by that?
Well, once again, he, at least as he explains it, it's the cost in life and suffering. And the calculus of lives and suffering is very hard to measure. Is one life worth 10 people suffering? Once again, that's a very difficult thing. But there's a gray area where Luther would argue in the gray area you should go ahead and fight the war if your duly constituted authorities ask you to. But there are cases where it's clearly no longer gray, where, let's say in his case, there's a town in dispute. And one Princeton takes over that town. No lives are lost, but it's taken over. The first one says, that belongs to me. So he's going to go and fight a war. And it's going to cost thousands of people's lives to get that town back. Luther would argue then that the means are not commensurate with the end.
Just to refresh my own memory, what was the destruction of the 100 Years' War that took place? Wasn't it some 70% of Germany?
It was a very, over 30 years' war was fought initially between Protestant and Catholic, and later just between different states. It went from 1618 to 1648. Some estimates are as high as 70% of the population was killed.
Because we have a tendency to think of this nice, neat little battle instead of recognizing the destruction that took place then. It could be fairly close to what we're talking about.
Well, the 70%, an awful lot of that was by disease, famine, what have you, not actually, far more were killed. By the fallout, the effect of crops being destroyed and disease. Armies carry disease around the way a dog carries fleas. Other comments or questions?
The one that probably is more difficult for us than any is the one we haven't talked about.
Yeah, rebellion.
Revolution. It's significant historically, I think, that it seems to me at least the age of revolution is that which immediately follows upon the whole event with the church.
Right.
The church disintegrates, and disintegration is probably the appropriate word there, so does the empire, and so do the princes begin to say, well, shoot, if Luther can take shots at the Holy Father, we might as well take shots at the emperor, and pretty soon...
Well, especially because the church in Luther's day was a state as well.
Yes.
It combined both. Well, we didn't get to that.
But that's probably has some of the most difficult issues for
Luther. Yeah, well, Luther also has very little to offer us.
That's not all very helpful.
You have to go to Calvin and Calvinists if you want to deal more in a more sophisticated way with this issue. Next time, tomorrow, I think also at 10:45, is the two kingdoms, or the two governments, which is perhaps the most problematic of Luther's legacies. And yet, I think if we talk about it, you'll see that it's more complex than you may have been led to believe. Of course, you may not want to know how complex it is. If you do, come tomorrow.